Earth Patrol presents Randy Caden's Generation X on KBGAFM, Missoula, Montana.
Hey, it's Randy from Generation X. Another one of my favorite interviews is Ian MacKay, founder of Discord Records. Played in the Teen Idols, Minor Threat, Fugazi. It's a really trippy project now with his wife called The Evens. It's a great interview. Henry Rollins' best friend. Still out there doing it. It's a great interview. We talk about all the bands that influenced him out of the D.C. area and why he got into punk rock. It's a great interview, and once again, thanks for listening.
Hello, good people. Ian MacKay of Minor Threat. You're listening to Generation X Radio on KBGA-FM, Missoula, Montana.
You know, I mean, of course, back in the day, I was a big Minor Threat fan. I saw you do the West Coast and stuff like that. How did you get involved with the whole punk rock deal at a young age?
What shows did you go to?
I saw you in a Arena Space in Fresno. And I
oh, the warehouse?
Yeah, at the warehouse in
Fresno. Capital Punishment show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, on the way out, I was looking for my buddy Don Fisher, and I ran him over in my truck on accident. But that's
you ran him
story.
Over?
Yeah, I ran up his leg in my dad's truck. He saw me leaving, so he was jumping.
Oh, were you the guy that spun out of the driveway and threw the gravel everywhere and broke all the windows?
No, that wasn't me. But it's funny you remember that. That was a crazy night.
Fresno night, man.
That was Fresno night. And I've seen Fugazi. I've seen you at the Crest Theater in Sacramento. That was a great show. I haven't seen the Evens yet. But let's go.
We played an Indian restaurant in Sacramento. That was great. The Evens did. That was a really cool show. All right, to answer your question, do you want to know how I got into punk rock?
Yeah, I want to know, like, at what point in your life did you go from being school kid to the defiant, hey, you know what, I want to do something different?
I think I was always defiant and wanted to do something different since day one, pretty much. I think that I found my community in the underground. And I think in the late 70s, that underground was really, for me at least, embodied by what was called new wave, punk, and then hardcore. Hardcore is something that I feel like my generation kind of cracked it. I remember clearly, you know, saying like we were hardcore punks because we were trying to differentiate ourselves from either the new wave people, which would sort of like the B-52s, kind of, you know, silly tie, people wearing ties and stuff, and trying to differentiate ourselves from the more nihilistic kind of English, kind of junky, Sid Vicious kind of thing. So we referred to ourselves as hardcore punks. But ultimately, that underground scene, that community, for me, was something that I had been searching for my whole life, which was essentially a population of people that would question conventional thinking across the board. So I think throughout in my lifetime, I mean, as a kid, I always was defiant. I always felt like, not defiant, like, you know, I hated everybody, thought I was better than everybody, but just rather that I just wanted to do things differently. So even, you know, I was a skateboarder when skateboarding was considered like the dumbest thing on earth. And, you know, we just skateboarded all the time. And I think in skating, I think that really taught me a lot about the ability to redefine the world that was around me, to look at the world in a way that other people don't look at it, to make of it what I would. And I think that I was always interested in music, but had given up on the idea of actually playing music because it seemed out of reach. Because at the time, the way the music world was sort of presented was, it was sort of something like for professionals to do that kids shouldn't try at home, you know, or you'd have to go, you have to be like this, like incredible, like guitar player to even think about being in a band. And I didn't know how to do it. I just wanted to play music. I didn't want to go through all that kind of rigmarole. So, at some point though, in my high school, friends of mine got into new wave or punk, And, you know, initially I was arguing with them about whether it was any good. And at some point they said, have you actually ever listened to it? And the truth was I hadn't. I just wanted to argue with them. So then I borrowed a bunch of records, which did not make any sense to me upon first listening. I really remember just feeling like the music just sounded so weird in my ears. It just didn't. It was so different than anything I had ever heard before. And it was scary. And usually if something scares me, I tend to go towards it because I know that it's not lethal. I just want to know why I reacted that way. What was it touching within me? And I think probably ultimately what I was really scared of was that it was something that if I was to get involved with, I was going to be doing it for the next 3 decades. And I think that's really, but you know, I went that way. I went that way because I felt like that's where I want to be. And I actually kind of quit skateboarding because it was antithetical to punk at the time. Like the kids around here in Washington or this area who are skateboarders, as soon as I cut my hair off, they just, ostracized me, called me all sorts of names. And so I was like, all right, well, that's, you guys keep on skating. I'm going to be like, you do your thing. I'm going to be a punk rocker. I still skated on my own, but it was not like that. Later years, punk and skating kind of merged, but at that time, they're still quite distinct, at least in this part of the world. And really, from the first show I saw was this show, The Cramps. And in that one show alone, when I went into the room, it was such a visceral experience because it was they're right in my face. And furthermore, those hundreds of people, the place was just jammed, and the variety of people there and the extreme kind of positions they were taking about whether it was a fashion thing or a political thing or a sexual thing or whatever, these people just had these really extreme confrontational sort of anti-establishment positions, which I really appreciated. And I thought, this is where I want to be because I'm a freak and this room is a room full of freaks and that's where I belong.
So was that one of your earliest influences? Was it Cramps? What were some of the other bands that kind of made you stick there?
Well, the first show I saw was the Cramps, and then I saw the Clash. And I thought the Clash were okay, but they were sort of a rock band. That was 79. I remember thinking, they're good, but their presentation was pretty rock and roll. There were a couple of bands from D.C. that I quite liked. There was this band, White Boy, that actually I went to junior high school with one of the kids sort of connected to that band, and they were a father-son band. And I bought the single. This is even before I was into punk rock. I bought the single because my friend was selling it. So I think they were like White Boy and this band Slicky Boys. There's just a few like local bands I thought were kind of cool. And then in, I think, May or June of 79, the Damned came to D.C., and we were all huge Damned fans. And I snuck into the show. I was under 18, which was a drinking age at the time, and I snuck into that show using a fake ID. It was a naval sea cadet card that a friend of mine had stolen, and we just taken Polaroid photos of ourselves and laminated them on. My name was Kurt Mullings. I remember that. We went to that show, which was, the Damned were incredible, but the opening band was the Bad Brains. And they were they're from D.C. I had seen them around because they actually were at the Cramps show. I saw these guys, these guys were just the coolest looking punks I'd ever seen in my life. And and I'd see them in Georgetown, which is sort of like an area where record stores were at the time. And I'd see them at shows and those are the Bad Brains. And then I'd heard one cassette, of a demo tape of theirs. It was pretty cool sounding, but when seeing them live, I just knew that I had just seen one of the greatest bands of all time, and I think the Bad Brains were just central. So in the early days, I'd say it was like the British punk scene and the DC punk scene, and then I remember buying one of the first records I bought was a 10-inch by the Dickies, and that was sort of one of the first LA punk band I had come across, and then I started studying up on LA punk and came across Danger House Records. I just was absolutely enchanted by the LA punk scene. I just love the Germs and the Weirdos and, the Eyes and the Dills and, you know, all these bands that were like, there's so much activity out there. And then, of course, you know, Black Flag showed up, and they were just hugely important in my life, that band. This, you know, hugely important band. And obviously, my best friend ended up singing for them. So it was, they played quite a role in my time.
So, and then when you got going, what were your, some of your first projects?
The first band I was in was a band called The Slinkies. We played our one and only show in August of 79, and the singer went to college. So we got a new singer, and we changed the name of the band to the Teen Idles, IDLES Idles. And we were together for about a year. I played bass in these bands, by the way. The Teen Idles came out to Los Angeles in the summer of 1980. We took a Greyhound bus out to the West Coast. Our first show we ever played outside of Washington, D.C. was in Los Angeles. We were so not interested in playing New York. Like, everyone's like, you got to go to New York. But we're from Washington, D.C., and we had a chip on our shoulder. We're like, we're going to go to L.A. because that's where the real punk is. So we took a Greyhound bus out. Our roadie was Henry Rollins. I mean, that was my best friend at the time, and he came with us. And we had, you know, this guy, Mark Sullivan, and Henry were our two roadies. And we went out, which is funny because we actually were on a Greyhound bus, and all we had was a bass, a guitar, and a pair of drumsticks. So I don't know why we had roadies, but this is. So we just arrived. We played a show at the Hong Kong Cafe in Los Angeles. We played with a bunch of bands, the Mentors, and I think Vox Pop, and a band called Puke Spit and Guts. And there's, you know, not many people there. We got paid $16. But we met a bunch of young punks there, like kids, West Coast punk kids, Oxnard Crew kids, and so forth. And then we went up to San Francisco, and we did a show at the Mahuhay Gardens, which we made $11. The show that we were originally booked on at the Mabuhay was opening for the Dead Kennedys, and we got bumped from the bill because the guy who was booking the shows didn't like the photo we sent him. He just dropped us without telling us. So we had taken the bus all the way there, and we got there, and incredible. But we went to the show anyway, which was just amazing. And we met the Circle Jerks people. And, of course, we were excited because Keith Morris, who had been in Black Flag, and we were very excited to meet him. And Circle Jerks were just phenomenal. It was before, you know, their record had come out, or it was before we had heard the record. I think it was before the record came out. We met a bunch of the early L.A. punks, like a lot of the people you might see in Decline of the Western Civilization, the X-Head and the Alva Brothers and so forth. And we met Biafra and the Flipper people. It was just an incredible experience. So, and then after that, after Teen Idles, that band broke up in fall of 80, and I wanted to sing because I've been writing a lot of the lyrics, and we started Minor Threat. So then Minor Threat was together for 3 years. Give or take.
And would you consider that? I mean, that's. I mean, I relate you to. You know, I knew you were in the Teen Idles, but I knew Minor Threat was big in the skate. I mean, we were all the skaters, and so there was your skateboarders coming back to that type of music right there.
Right, right. Oh yeah, I mean, when Minor Threat played. I mean, you have to know that, for instance, like when Henry and I were skaters. So we actually, in 1978, when I was 16, he was 17. We took a Greyhound bus to California to go skating, just the two of us. We went to Winchester and we went to Upland, like the park. We skated the pipeline, not the actual pipeline, but the park. And then we went to a contest, this one of the Hester Pro Bowl series at this Big O skate park in Orange County. And we saw the Dogtown people, and they were our heroes, like Jay Adams and Peralta and all these people, and met Peralta there. And so years later, when Minor Threat came out, I met Alva. Well, when the Teen Idles played in San Francisco, I met Alva, he's one of my heroes. So that was just, you know, we were psyched to meet him. And then when Minor Threat came out, I met Adams. He came. They were all punk rockers. It was just kind of cool. It was like suddenly, like that world just became punk. I was real happy about that. But Minor Threat was like, we were punks, and we played music that I think related to skaters because I was a skater. I am a skater. Like on, you know, that's like the way whether I skateboard or not, I'm just going to be a skater till I die. And I know that. I just feel like that that music would resonate because there's a certain kind of radicalness that I think plays a role that or at least skaters can relate to. Although I would never say we were a skate punk band, because I was really the only person in the band that skated, to speak, you know, really. But it was great to, you know, meet all those people and to still know them all. I mean, to still meet people and to, you know, like Olsen and Dwayne Peters, all these people. It's just cool.
Well, you fell into that skate rock category, which is actually a category of its own.
Yeah, but, you know, there's something that we never really, well, it wasn't our thing. I mean, I'm glad skateboard guys or people were really into us. It's great, but I think for you as a skateboarder, we fell in that category. I think for somebody who was not a skateboarder, they wouldn't think of us that way, which is exactly the way I like it. Like, I just want it to be whatever people want to make of it. It doesn't. We never hyped our skateboard thing. I remember one of the dudes, probably Brian Brandon or one of the guys from JFA, I remember him doing the interview where he just said, like, you know, Meyer Threat, those guys are posed. We're not a real skate punk band. I challenge him to skate a skate contest any day. And I'm like, yo, we never said we were. That's, like, not our thing. I'm not gonna have a skate off with you to prove that I'm. I mean, the truth is, as a skater, like, you know, I'm a reasonable skateboarder. Like, I, you know, basically, like, I skated pools and I skated, you know, did downhill and ramps and that kind of stuff. But, like, I was never particularly good. I just lived to skate.
Exactly. And that's part of it. You know, I think some of the greatest skateboarders will never be discovered because they don't care about that aspect of it.
Right.
So Minor Threat went to about 83, and then it was a little hiatus before Fugazi, right?
No, I was in a band called Embrace in 1985 and 86.
Oh. And then Egg Hunt?
Egg Hunt was a project that was recorded in 86. I was also in a project called Skewball. These are bands that didn't ever play show. They're just studio projects. So, but the Embrace was a band that was together from the summer of 85 till the spring of 86. And then in the fall of 86, I started practicing with Joe Lally on what would eventually become Fugazi. But we practiced for a year with different, like, we didn't start playing with Brendan, the drummer, until January of 87. And we actually, our first show was until September of 87, and we played as a three-piece. And then Guy did for another, about two more shows. Hold on 1 second for me. I'll be right back, okay? Hold on. Okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay. So, and Fugazi went for 12 or 13 years,
15
right?
years. From 87, the first show we played was September 87. The last show we played was November of 2002. November 2002. And then, at that point, the four of us, they basically we were like, wow, like people... There was so much life going on for people. Like everybody's having kids, and our parents were getting old and dying and sick, and there's just so much going on that we thought, all right, we need to put the band on ice for a while so we can attend to these other. Like, we've basically been working solidly for 15 years, and when you're on tour that much, you realize that there's a lot of things you just don't ever address that then bite you on the ass. So it was decided that we would just have to stop operating the way we were accustomed to. So we decided to put the band on what we call an indefinite hiatus, meaning that we didn't think we were breaking up because our position is, like, we're not like a store that goes out of business. We're actually four human beings that, if given the right circumstances, would, you know, we live to play music with each other. So it's sort of like the skating thing. Like, it's just like, it just is on. So the four of us are still super tight. I'm actually working with Brendan, the drummer, right now on a soundtrack stuff for this Matt Hoffman documentary. And, you know, Guy, like, we're all in touch. We talk to each other regularly, but we're just not working at the moment. So that's where that band is. And then I started playing with Amy and the Evens in 2004 or late 2003. And we toured for about 4 or 5 years, and then she and I had a kid. So we've been on paternity, maternity leave for the last about a year and a half.
And, Discord Records is, what is it, a 20-year anniversary?
30 years.
30-year anniversary.
Our first record came out in December of 1980.
And that keeps you busy to this date, right?
I'm working right now.
You're working right now. Now, I was reading a little tidbit about you got involved with a soundbite for the Kent State shootings.
Yeah, but that was just a little thing. One of the guy, a person involved with an organization that is involved, like connected to that, asked me if I could just help them because he knew that I had access to some studio stuff, and he just asked me if I could help him with some audio stuff, and I did. I was happy because he's a friend of mine, but it wasn't. I mean, though, actually, ironically, it's something. The Kent State thing is something that really affected me as a kid. I was 8 years old when that happened. When these college students were killed by the National Guard, it was something that really, I think, kind of traumatized me because it was one of the first really clear examples I'd ever seen where, like, the U.S. government would actually kill its own people straight up. And it really was upsetting, but I wasn't a student of it necessarily. You know, I mean, I was interested in it, and it had a real effect on me. I met this guy because we had done a benefit. Fugazi had done a benefit for a group that works with a group that's based on at Kent State University that is basically connected to that event that is involved with student activism. So we did a benefit for them, and I met this fellow. His name is Alan Canfora. He's one of the students that was shot, not killed, obviously, but he, so we became, you know, acquaintances, and occasionally we'd speak on the phone, and he just called me one day and said, "Hey, I got this recording. I think I can hear the order to shoot," because it's always been disputed whether or not this soldiers just started firing randomly or if there was actually a direction to shoot. And he thought that he could hear somebody ordering them to shoot, you know, sort of like, you know, ready, aim, fire kind of thing. So, yeah. But it was on the recording was really quite noisy, and he wanted to know if I had any way to try to clear up the sound so he could actually make it out. And I did what I could. From my point of view, you can clearly hear something that could be in order to shoot. And I think that alone would, I think that alone merits an actual forensic audio examination as opposed to giving me a copy of the recording. And like, I'm a layman. I just went to a studio and messed around with it. So I actually think there's other people who are, you know, they're really, really technically savvy and brilliant audio engineers who could probably really do something with that. So I hope that someday that will be addressed. But that was my role of that. It was just to helping this guy out.
So back to Discord Records. Who's the hot and upcomer on your label right now?
So every record we've ever put out is essentially people associated with that original scene. I mean, whether it's, you know, it could be generations later, but still coming out of that sort of specific group. And the label, in other words, so the label doesn't actually, we don't sign bands really. We just are documenting things that we think are important. And because we are tied to a community, and since a community is a living thing, and since living things always die, eventually I think that, you know, the label will have no purpose because that, you know, so things have been very quiet over the last couple of years here in Washington in terms of that underground music scene. There isn't a lot of really, a lot of momentum or real excitement. So, at the moment, there's really not much we're putting out. There's a band we like, a few bands that we've worked with over the years, a band called Medications that are doing a new record. I imagine the Evens will do another record. There's little things here and there, but at the moment, it's pretty quiet. And it's all right, you know. I mean, you know, as I said, in December will be our 30th anniversary, and it's not like I'm feeling like, you know, it failed. You know, I just think, like, that's the way life is. We'll see what happens. But, you know, let me tell you something. I'll just tell you straight up, like, I'm not interested in the record industry. And the reason I did a label is because that's how much I hated that industry. I just didn't want to deal with their nonsense. So it wasn't my dream to run a record label. My dream was to make music and to make music on my terms.
That's the best way to have it. And if you can rearrange your life to where you don't have to compromise and do it your way, then you're the most successful person out there.
I mean, it's just a matter of work. And I never stopped working. That's a thing. Like, people talk about do-it-yourself, and like, well, the do-it-yourself thing is kind of hard. Like, there's only the operative, there's three words in do-it-yourself. But the operative words are do it. If you don't do it, then it's just, if it's just about yourself, you're screwed. You got to do it. And I'm, you know, I'm 47 years old. I'm still answering mail. I'm doing interviews. I'm still like today we have a big long discussion about all this weird business stuff and still involved with like, I'm going through stuff. I'm getting things sorted out. I'm always working on the label and or the band. I mean, basically everything I've ever done, I still am involved with. I take responsibility for what's behind me too. So it's just a lot of work, but that's what I do. I just work. And it doesn't, people say, God, you're so lucky you live off your music. I don't live off my music. I live off my work. I work my ass off so I can play my music without having to be dependent upon it.
Thank you for listening to Generation X here on Earth Patrol. Transmission complete. All frequencies are clear.